Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to violence.
Welcome to Lost in the Static.
Another episode of Lost in the Static. It's just me this week, though, guys. Unfortunately, Scott will not be joining us. It's nothing like he's taking a break from the show where he and I are fighting. The real answer is far, far more benign. He can't find a day off of work for us to record. He is working almost nonstop, so hopefully he'll be back next week. In the meantime, why don't you guys go to adamandeve.com, use the promo code STATIC to get 50% off of a single item, to get 3 free DVDs, to get a free mystery gift, and to get free shipping in the United States. It helps us out, and then maybe Scott won't have to work as much, and he'll be on the show a little more often. Isn't that right, special guest Alex Jowski from Geek Juice Media?
Yes, that is correct.
Alex, this is your first time on this show, and unfortunately, your first time on this show is going to be kind of truncated with you and me. I did an interview with low-budget filmmaker Ted Newsome a while ago, and I'm going to be playing that in the middle of this. I let you listen to it the other day. Without spoiling what's coming in this, what did you think of me talking to Ted Newsome there?
It was fascinating. The guy knows what he's talking about. He's done some great work. It was a great interview to listen to.
Now, for those that don't know who Ted Newsome is, and I know this might seem like it's a little more suited to a radiodrome, and there's a reason for that. I initially recorded this interview with the intention of it being for Radiodrome, since it's movie-based, but then basically with Scott's schedule, I kind of needed a filler, and I don't want to do a whole show with Alex because he's a real shit, so I figured I'd put the Ted Newsome interview in here.
Hey, and it kind of works, because normally you've got Scott here to cancel out your cynicism, and you've got Ted Newsome in this interview to cancel that cynicism out, so.
Very true. I hadn't thought of that, but very true. So for Ted Newsome, he was a big name. He was always around in the late 80s and early 90s. He's directed movies such as Naked Monster and Evil Spawn. He's been the editor and writer on numerous other projects, including one of the ones that you'll hear him talk about is the never-made canon Spider-Man project. I know you knew about this, Alex. What he says really kind of shows you just how fucked up low-budget Hollywood was in the 90s, huh?
Yes, it does. It does.
One of the things I initially wanted to talk to him about was the difference between 90s low-budget filmmaking and today. And one of the big problems is I think low-budget filmmaking today can't hold a candle to low-budget filmmaking in the 90s. I really can't. I really don't.
My thoughts are it varies. The majority of low-budget filmmaking today is nothing like it was in the 90s, but I think that's just because there's so much of it that the ones that are very much like it used to be are so few and far between they generally go unnoticed.
Well, there's a certain level of quality, too. You've got these, you know, you'll hear Ted bring it up, like somebody that shoots a backyard zombie epic. In the 90s, you could have put that out on video, and you could have made your money back. Today, there are theatrical films that are made for theatrical releases that can't even get out there today.
And I think it goes back to the fact that since everybody can do it now, there's so much on the market.
Yeah, one of the topics I bring up to Ted, and you'll hear his thoughts are quite different than mine. Well, you know, being able to get a $700 camera from Walmart democratized the situation. I don't think it made it better. I think it just made, and I know I'm going to come across as a cinema snob with this, Alex, but in all honesty, just because you can make a movie doesn't necessarily mean you should or that you have the ability to make a good movie. I'm one of those people that thinks if you can't try to make a good movie, you shouldn't make a movie for the sake of making a movie.
Yes, and Ted in the interview goes into very much the same thing about you have to have the knowledge of the language kind of thing.
I want to get your thoughts, Alex, a little bit, because you're not a lot younger than Scott and I. Scott and I being the same age, but we are older than you. So we obviously grew up with a different type of direct-to-video film than you grew up with. When you were growing up, what did direct-to-video film mean to you?
Usually meant crap. That this was not good to make, not good enough to make it to a theater. Just like a lot of the direct-to-video sequels, for instance. You see a lot of those.
By that, I'm assuming you mean like the Scanners movies, the Children of the Corn movies, the Silent Night, Deadly Nights, those kind of things.
Yeah, where you had the first one or two in the theaters, and then you'd get the next ones that were just direct video. And you know, okay, this is going to suck because not because it's a sequel, but this is clearly direct video. It was not good enough to earn a theatrical release. And that's how I felt about it at the time, that you had to earn your way into a theater.
Do you still feel the same way about those types of movies? Look, for the moment, let's leave out the modern direct-to-video. Now, the new you that's over 30, do you still see those, say, Children of the Corn movies in that same light?
No, mostly because now I know that it wasn't a quality thing that kept them out of theaters. It was marketing decisions. It was the ability to actually get into there with your material, you know, and the actual cost of distributing on video. You'd make your money back and more of it faster than if you had a theatrical release, which is expensive.
Yeah, for prints and advertising and theater space and... Yeah, you can put something out on video in the 90s, and there were so many video stores that it doesn't matter how obscure your movie was, that week of new release, countrywide, you'd make back your budget in that first week of new release, just like how most movies nowadays theatrically want to make back their budget, you know, opening weekend or opening week.
Which is really what screws theater owners.
And that's also what screws direct-to-video today. There aren't that many video stores anymore. You are not going to make back your money with Netflix Instant Queue. You're not going to make back your money. Because, I mean, yes, there's always going to be piracy. The piracy in the 90s was nothing compared to torrenting today. So if you're on a money-making level, you almost can't make your money back on a direct-to-video unless you've already got a pre-sold commodity.
Well, the thing with it, having it on Netflix or through different, like, on-demand services through cable companies or Redbox, you can make your money back. It's not going to be as easy and quick a process, and you have to do a lot of self-promotion on it, but... thanks to all the different social networking tools nowadays, that's not that difficult. I mean, it can be done, but there's a lot of competition out there, and you're really going to have to work to earn it.
And see, I disagree with that, and so does Ted. Let's go to the interview with Ted Newsom, and then Alex and I will be back to talk about some of the things he said. All right, Mr. Newsom, you're a low-budget filmmaker. What was it like in the 90s versus being a low-budget filmmaker today? You've gone through that entire transition period. Is it better or worse now than what it was? And I mean, just not just for you, but for the actors or for the market in general.
Well, things have changed a great deal, certainly since I started. I moved to California in 78, and I've kind of been on the low-budget periphery ever since, with one or two exceptions. But prior to, let's say, the invention of really good home video cameras, making a film was a hideously expensive procedure, even a low-budget film. I mean, you couldn't shoot a 16-millimeter feature for less than $15,000, $25,000, $30,000. You know, and that's kind of bare bones. With the advent of home video, and particularly digital video of the last 4, 5, 6 years, really anybody that could afford a camera and a couple of memory chips can go out and shoot a movie. Whether it's any good or not is something else. But it really has democratized the idea of making low-budget films. So, the flip side of that is there's no market for them. I can't tell you the last time that somebody shot a backyard zombie film that played at the local fourplex. You know, you don't get it, because what has happened in major films is that budgets have shot up. People get paid a lot more. And, you know, instead of a low-budget film being $100,000 or $200,000, you know, a low-budget film is $5 or $6 million, pretty much out of the realm of shooting a zombie film in the backyard. So it works both ways. You know, I mean, can you get them out? Yes, you can post them on YouTube or burn discs for your friends and maybe make $5 a piece. But as for making your money back, it's nearly impossible. So there have been major changes.
Do you think that is because it's become so democratized, as you put it, that it's sort of diluted the market? Or was the bubble about ready to burst anyway, and the democratizing just came in a little bit too late?
I think it's a combination of all of those factors. Making movies is a fun idea, and it's fun to do, too. So the attraction to do it is great. The problem is that most people with home video cameras don't know grammar, don't know film grammar. Assuming you're a writer because you wrote to grandma when you were 10. No, writing a letter or even writing a coherent sentence is not the same thing as writing a book or an article. And most people simply assume if they point a camera and zoom in and zoom out a couple of times and have somebody wave, that they're a filmmaker. No, they're not. I mean, you need to understand how to tell a story. And not everybody does. That's the one saving grace that keeps a lot of us actually working, that we actually know where to put the periods and where to use a comma and so on, or at least the cinema equivalent of that. My friend Dave Dakota, who's made about 80 or 100 low-budget films and a couple of fairly mid-range films, said to me about 8 or 10 years ago, we're talking about the high-end prosumer video cameras, and he said, "Ted, we're out of business." And he was referring specifically to that anybody can pick up a camera and shoot something. Nobody anticipated the net, though, and that has been a major change. Yes, things are immediately accessible, and you can get these, you can download the most obscure thing, you can get the new Batman film on torrent, and you have your own copy of it. Yeah, and what you're doing, cheating the owners of the film and the people that participate in it out of what they were expecting to make. And that's been going on now for, a good solid 10 years. Having been screwed a number of times on video distribution and having my stuff pirated and so on, put on the net. On the one hand, you're flattered. Gee whiz, somebody actually likes it enough to steal it. On the other hand, that's money out of your pocket, which makes going through the motions of making a movie less attractive. If you're doing it on nothing, which a lot of us do, or on enough to pay rent, the roll of the dice means, okay, we're going to make some money down the line when people pay to see it. But if people are uploading it onto some torrent and downloading 50 or 100 copies or 1,000 or whatever, forget it. You just wasted your time. And it's very distressing in this end. I can understand the idea of how much fun it is. Gee whiz, I got the latest Star Wars, man. I got it for free. Well, fine, but you've just cheated all the actors and the writers and everything else who make a tiny piece of all that. You're not just cheating 20th Century Fox or Lucas or Disney or whomever. You're robbing the people who knock themselves out to make a good movie. So nobody anticipated that with the internet. I mean, nobody anticipated the gigantic leaps in information technology which made this possible. So here we are, and what do? Nobody really knows.
Obviously, it's to a larger scale, but you had those problems in the 90s with the VHS bootleggers, didn't you?
You did, but the difference is that you'd have to... digital copying means essentially you're copying, the copy looks exactly the same as the original. And you didn't have that when you had analog copying, when your master was a 35mm print or a 1-inch copy of it or a 3/4 inch or copying a VHS to a VHS. It degenerated a great deal. With the advent of digital technology, you have precise copies. I mean, they are no different from the original. At which point, you know, it's wonderful. It's expanded piracy. And more so in China than over here. People do it, but you run the risk of being arrested in the United States. You know, they do it by the hundreds of thousands, the millions offshore in China and so on. And they pay nothing for it, and they just keep all the money. And you couldn't do that. You really couldn't do that in the VHS days. A VHS copy looks cruddier than a VHS done from a high-end master. So, the problem existed in its aborning stage, but it truly came of its own when DVD took over.
You talked about how you can't sell a film. It's obviously more difficult nowadays to sell a low-budget film. From what I've seen in numerous documentaries, which you happen to be in, you know, Charles Band, Cinemaker and all that, it seems like making the film is the easiest part. Seems to me selling it is far more difficult. Am I correct?
Yes, comparatively so, yeah. And it's funny because I think it takes a different personality type to love selling something as much as a filmmaker or an artist or an actor or a writer or whatever loves doing what they do. And they're completely different. Someone can marshal a crew of 5 or 15 or 100 or 300 and keep them focused toward creating, you know, an object and keep some sort of creativity and energy going, you know, other than paying them and that too. That's a whole lot different from taking a movie or two movies or 10 to Cannes and trying to convince some guy from Bratislava to shell out more than $3,000 for the exclusive rights to your zombie movie, or Iceland, or you know, Ghana, or whatever. Yeah, it's a lot harder. It's a lot different. It's different the way that surgery is different from upholstery. That's not to degrade upholstery or surgery for that matter. It's just it takes a different type of person. Generally speaking, that person is not going to be somebody who's enthusiastic about making a film. It's going to be somebody who's enthusiastic about making a product and selling it. The classic example is Sir James Carreras. Jimmy Carreras was the head of Hammer Films from the mid-40s till he retired in the early 70s. And he didn't give a flip about movies. Now, the fact is that Hammer made a whole bunch of really neat movies. The remakes of Frankenstein and Dracula with Peter Cushing, Christopher Lee, 1 Million Years B.C., She, and you know, a lot of stuff. They were well-crafted, well-done, beautifully designed, well-acted, and so on. Jimmy Carreras didn't care. When they did Dracula, which is the first or second major hit they had, they had a meeting, Peter Cushing, Christopher Lee, Jimmy Carreras, Anthony Hines, who's the other partner, Hammer, a meeting at Universal, and Universal was crazy about it, and Universal said to him, "Gentlemen, your film has kept us out of bankruptcy." And Jimmy Carreras said, "Whatever you want, we'll make them. If you want Strauss waltzes, we'll make them." He didn't care, and that's really the perfect sort of person to have in charge of an enterprise like that, who simply, you know, knows how to finesse somebody, knows how to strike a deal, and then just keeps their hands off and says, "Okay, tell me when it's over so I can go out and sell it." And most artists or so-called artists, would-be filmmakers and real filmmakers and storytellers, they're not like that. Pitching an idea is much different from writing it. Selling yourself as a director with a vision is a lot different from actually being practical and knowing how to get coverage and knowing how to motivate an actor and knowing when to draw the line at something or other. They're a lot different, and there aren't a lot of people who have both of those traits. They're very rare, and those who do combine them generally are very successful.
On the flip side of that, do you see a lot of people that really don't care that they are just making product? I love Tobe Hooper and I love his work, but I think the guy's just making movies to make movies at this point, and he doesn't really care whether they're good movies.
Well, there is that. But the thing is, after you've done something, whatever it is, whether you're a banker or a baker or a bicycle repair guy or a bricklayer, after you've done it for a number of years, really the specialness wears off, it simply becomes, this is what I do. So, you know, you might very well be right about Toby Hooper. I've never been a particular fan of his work. But, yeah, I mean, he's been doing this for 25, 30 years now. It's his job. I doubt very seriously whether he's ever going to have the enthusiasm that he had when he made the first Chainsaw Massacre or the documentary he did before that, because he's never going to be 22 years old again. You know, your attitude toward life and yourself changes as you get older. Hitchcock, for example, you know, I adore all of his stuff. It's technically brilliant and fun to watch it, no matter when he did it. But there, you know, there's a sense of passivity or even superciliousness about a lot of his later films that isn't in the films of the 30s or even 40s. There you can see somebody stretching his arms and saying, you know, I'm going to do all of this. This is going to be wonderful. The later films are, I know how to do this. Stand back. I'm going to do this. And that's just kind of a, you know, that's what happens when you're a human being.
And now this is just the way I look at it. You being from this world may disagree. I think you have companies like The Asylum that are putting out, frankly, garbage that they know is garbage just to put out product. They are demeaning what a low budget or independent film actually means to me. Because to me, I grew up watching low budget films like yours and Charles Band's and David Dakota's, and they were real movies. These Asylum things, maybe I'm being arrogant, but they're not real movies. They're just product. I really don't know if you're going to agree with me or disagree with me on that.
No, I agree with you. I've seen, I've only seen one, that riff they did on Day the Earth Stood Still. It actually played on television a few weeks ago. I saw it. It was the first Asylum film that I ever saw. And, you know, I liked it. I liked it because it was trying to be a real movie against the odds, because the budget's against it, and the, you know, the big headquarters that the military were in. And it looked like an office that where they bought a bunch of used computers for $10 a piece and parked them around. I mean, that looked like nonsense. And the fact that the city was deserted, well, you know, in a low budget film, you can't hire extras, so you just shoot on deserted streets. But it wasn't entirely bad. I do think the guy who runs that company, I forget what his name is, I don't think he's any more evil than old Sam Arkoff and Jim Nicholson. You know, anybody else who's run a company, he's clearly looking at it as a product, and they've got a gimmick. They make films for a tiny bit of money, and they turn, you know, they turn a profit. Cynical? You betcha. So is Lloyd Kaufman of Troma. He's funny about being cynical, but he knows the Troma product, the best Troma product, stinks like an old horse. You know? And the worst stuff is just unwatchable. But, you know, that's his game. And people that like Toxic Avenger keep buying the stuff. So I don't entirely agree with you, but I don't disagree either. How's that for a political answer?
That's a very political answer, and it's a very acceptable answer.
Good.
On another topic, you've made lots of movies and worked on lots of films in the low-budget arena where arguably, obviously there's some parameters, but arguably you have control over the final product. Would you want to work with a $100 million budget if you had to be told what product to make for Tom Cruise or Sylvester Stallone, or would you rather stay in the low-budget realm where you arguably have complete creative control?
I'll equivocate. Having never been in, with one blessed exception, having never really been in the position of the former, that might be fun. The pressure on someone in that position and trying to make a film where there's a hell of a lot of money riding on it, and a lot of egos, and a lot of people who are concerned with their own part over everybody else. Yeah, that's a bear. You know, would it have been fun? Will it be fun to be associated with something like that? Sure, that'd be kind of neat. I don't know anybody that would, and most of the people that I know, who I've ever worked with, if offered $100 million, would say, fine, we're going to do 100 films, you know, or 1,000.
The Roger Corman philosophy.
Well, you know, there's a certain cynicism to that, too. I think, actually, Corman's setup, New World and now Concord, is kind of the upscale template of the Asylum. Figure out what the title is, figure out what's going to be hot and what we can coast on, and make it for peanuts. That's pretty much what Corman's been doing for the last 25 years. Occasionally, you know, they'll actually come up with an idea and keep stealing from themselves, but, yeah.
So I remember reading an interview with Corman, or like when he made Battle Beyond the Stars, he hated spending $2 million on that. He said, I could have made 4 films for this one movie.
Did you ever hear, by the way, the story of the Corman's Fantastic Four?
I've seen it too. It's honestly, I think it's better than the big budget Fantastic Four, because I hated that movie.
I don't know if your listeners ever had. We had written Spider-Man for Canon and gotten to know Stan Lee, and he liked us, and we did a couple of scripts for Marvel directly, which were never made. And then we got a gig writing Sub-Mariner for New World, because they had bought Marvel, or gotten into a deal with Marvel. At that time, they wanted to do Fantastic Four, but they couldn't, because a German company called Neue Konstantin had the rights. And you know, that perturbed Marvel, because that was one of their, with Spider-Man, that was probably their biggest title to try to make some money with. Nobody in that era, very few people understood how to make comic book movies. So Neue Konstantin was running to the end of their 5-year contract with Marvel. You know, they had 5 years to put the thing together and put together enough money to do the movie. And, you know, it had not happened. Because at that time, that was post-Superman 4, which pretty much died. It certainly underperformed. And nobody was particularly interested in doing in superhero movies, anything. That's why Canon got the rights to Spider-Man so cheaply. Actually, Roger Corman had had them before that, and he didn't put anything together. So Neue Konstantin had faith in Fantastic Four, and they'd written a pretty elaborate script. It would not have been cheap, and it would be a major deal. But their contract was running out, and Marvel had no intention of renewing them and giving them another 5 years to poke around the world and try to put the money together. They wanted to resell it to somebody else. But Neue Konstantin rather cleverly went back over their original contract and realized that inherent in the contract was a clause that actually is usually in any contract like this, that in addition to having the right to make the movie, they also had the right to do a remake. So they went, aha, and they went to Roger Corman, and they said, here's this script we have. We need you to make a movie for less than $1 million. And Corman said, oh, sure, okay. So
with Corman, that's not a problem.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I doubt that they put that much into it. It looks more like $500,000. And it was worth it to Neue Konstantin, because they were looking at, you know, having already spent probably $1 million on promotion and the script and everything else, and they were looking at doing a film for $20, $30, $40 million, which would then, you know, play around the world and make $100 million, whatever. That's what they were banking on. So they went to Corman and said, here's the money. We need you to do this script, but it's never going to be shown. Because the whole object was to make a movie which then fulfilled their contract with Marvel and then turn around and say, okay, now we're going to do the remake as we contractually agreed.
So it's basically a placeholder, if nothing else?
Straight out of Bowfinger. You know, the whole object was to do a film that would never be shown. But it was done. It was finished, sort of. And that then gave Neue Konstantin an extra 5 years. And they didn't tell anybody. They didn't tell the cast and the crew and the director. They didn't tell them that the whole object was well, we're never going to do this film. We're never going to send it out. Yeah, and so these guys, you know, God bless them, they did publicity and Starlog and everything else. And they had, you know, I thought pretty nifty-looking uniforms. Like Fantastic Four to me, but you can tell by looking at it. You've seen it, so I mean, you know, there are these grand ideas, like the four of them when they crash back to Earth after being dosed by gamma rays, you know, you never see the crash. You just see them laying on a grassy hillside with a couple of chunks of metal steaming here and there. And that's it. That's their rocket crash.
Personally, my favorite part of that whole thing, I absolutely loved that almost hologram-ish flame-on effect for the Human Torch at the end. I just, mm-hmm. I loved that. I thought that looked so mid-90s and so perfect for Human Torch.
Oh, I thought it was okay. I thought the design of the thing was great. It's in motion, less so. No, I mean, the thing is, the fun thing about that project was that the people who did it weren't in on the joke, and they took it absolutely seriously. And I don't think it's a bad film. Had they had any money at all, it would have been a terrific film. And you can tell by just structurally it works. The dialogue is good. It's comic booky, but not stupid, and I'm not over the top. They're taking it seriously. But it was all a gag. That's the wonderful irony of it.
When people think of the Spider-Man script, most people don't realize that Canon once not only had the rights to it, but went pretty deep into pre-production, if I'm not mistaken. I remember those Spider-Man photo covers that the comic books had that were supposedly of the actor that was going to be in the movie. Can you tell us a little bit about Spider-Man up through your involvement of the Canon Spider-Man?
Sure. Marvel had been trying to interest Hollywood in general, television or films, in material for years. And nobody did in the 60s into the 70s and so on. When I say nobody, there are the little small exceptions. There was the Steve Krantz, Ralph Bakshi cartoons with the song on it, Spider-Man, Spider-Man. Spidey makes occasional made past tense appearances on The Electric Company, and there was that CBS series, a Japanese series too, which most people don't know about. But basically, nobody was interested in doing comic book characters, and it wasn't until the Christopher Reeve Superman deal that anybody thought it was serious. And even then, you had people in charge of studios, producers, directors, and so forth, who were mostly in their 40s, 50s, or 60s, who still looked down on comic books. You know, that's kid stuff. Why would anybody want to do that? Well, I'm not going to do that kid's movie. Let's just make fun of it. You know, like that Batman series. Oh, great. So Marvel had a hard time getting anybody serious in their stuff, even Spider-Man. As I said, Roger Corman had it under option for probably a year and didn't do anything. And then Canon Films picked it up. And Canon, flame on, flame out. They had a ride for about 5 or 6 years.
I love Canon. I love Canon's product.
They're as cynical as anybody else. Menachem Golan, at least, who was the creative end of it, if you will, he loved making films. Now, the fact that he wasn't particularly great at it or tasteful, he was competent. He got them done. He's the kind of guy who started off when he was, 19, 20, 21, working on a crew, looking around and watching everything and say, boy, this is what I want to do. And I admire that. Anyway, so they picked up the rights to Spider-Man from Marvel very cheaply, I think for $100,000 for 5 years, which is nothing. Marvel would have made money had they made the film, but they didn't. Menachem apparently thought he was going to be creative, and they hauled in a writer named Leslie Stevens, who was a brilliant writer. He was one of the co-creators of The Outer Limits. But he wrote a treatment per Menachem Golan, because now, again, Golan was older than we are. He didn't grow up with comic books, so he just liked the idea of a Spider-Man. You know, like the Wolfman. The guy turns into a giant six-armed hideous freak, and he's suicidal about it, and he wants to kill himself. And there's like a mad doctor, and he wants to rule the world, and he's got a basement full of mutants, it's just awful. And Stevens...
It sounds like a Universal meets Ed Wood movie.
Yeah. Anyway, Stan Lee hated that. I can't imagine why. And we had done a script, Sergeant Fury, for Stan by then. And met with him, sat around, and we all smoked cigars. And so Stan said, "So what do you want to do next? We got all these characters here. We got the Incredible Hulk. We got the Mighty Thor. Well, so what character do you want to do?" And my partner and I both said at the same time, "Spider-Man." "Oh, God, I'd love to let you guys get a job, but that's what Ken and they don't listen to me. So what else we got? We can do the Human Torch. Or Submariner is good. And so what do you want to do?" And we both said, "Spider-Man." So Stan got us in, and we pitched our take on Spider-Man. We got the job, and we wrote it. And at the time, Cannon was overreaching their grasp. What they did really well, I think, is low-budget action pictures. They'd do a movie with Charles Bronson, pay him $1 million, and spend $1 million on the picture. But it would be super, and it would be neat. But they started to think much bigger than that. Let's do a film. Let's do an art film with Lena Vertmuller. There we go. Well, let's hire John Frankenheimer. He's worth $1 million. Oh, Stallone's got an idea. Let's do one with it. And it got rather grandiose. And luckily, Spider-Man fell right into that deal. They weren't going to do it cheaply. Budget, I think, was probably close to $20 million.
Now, was this when Toby Hooper was still involved, or was Albert Pyun the director at this point? Or Albert Pyun,
Early on, because he had a three-picture deal with Cannon, and he misbehaved so badly on the first two that they lost a little faith in him. Funhouse, apparently, most of his time was spent in the trailer going, I had a cold, apparently. And so things fell a little behind, it was up to the janitor to call action and cut, that kind of stuff. But he was associated with it for some reason when we were hired. And we actually, when we wrote it, we were assuming that he was going to direct it. And late in the game, when we had done the treatment and the story, they approved that. At that point, Joe Zito came on board. Joe had done Invasion USA with Chuck Norris, and a really neat slasher film called The Prowler. It's nothing different particularly, but it's just really stylish.
It's actually quite a brutal slasher film. I thought it's one of the more brutal ones from that era.
Yeah, and so he was excited about it. And he had pushed as hard as we did to get on Spider-Man. I mean, he really wanted to do it. His take, what he told to us, was that he's done a whole bunch of realistic films in a comic book way. Now he wants to do a comic book in a realistic way. And that fit fine. Because if you compare the backgrounds of, let's say, Spider-Man's New York and Superman's Metropolis, one's pretty grimy and real life, and that's the joy of it. I mean, it's a real New York. It's a real city. There are real problems. And the other is what we would classically call comic booky and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, so that's what we did. And Joe was the assigned director for a year, I think, our work, and he continued. They had an artist named Mentor Huebner, who was a wonderful production artist, do all the major set piece sketches. And they'd storyboarded every shot of it. Joe went from Hollywood to South Carolina to Italy to England looking for studio space that could hold us, because it's a huge picture. It was budgeted, as I say, at about $18 or $20 million. What mitigated against that were a lot of things. Cannon was overextended financially, but they had lucked into the fire sale or the yard sale that the guys who owned Superman were holding. They were trying to give away the franchise, basically, because they'd run it into the ground. What's the Salkins? So they bought the franchise from the Salkins and decided they were going to do Superman instead, or in addition to. And at the same time, they made a deal with Mattel to do Masters of the Universe. Well, so they couldn't do all three of them. Financially, it just wouldn't work. And the Superman was top-heavy with expensive talent because nobody wanted to do it. So they hiked their rates up. So with those two movies sucking up a lot of the capital that Cannon had, cut the budget in half, Spider-Man, $10 million or $8 million, And Joe Zito, having spent now more than a year on pre-production, he just said, you can't do this script for that amount of money. You know, I'm not going to do it. And he walked away from it. Now, with regard to those Marvel photographic covers, yeah, that was an actor stuntman named Scott Leva, who had done all the photographs, the pre-production photographs for Spider-Man that they used in ads, and a lot of personal appearances. I first met him at Comic-Con down in San Diego. I was speaking at one of those, which was neat. I was sitting at a dinner table with my date and Stan Lee and Spider-Man. How cool is that?
That's the kind of thing that gets you laid later that night.
Oddly enough, it didn't. And boy, was I steamed. But it's okay. I learned my lesson. Don't go to San Diego and think you're going to get laid. See, the last time I went, I did. So, well, you never know. So, Scotty Bleva, he was a wonderful stuntman and a very good actor. And he was in line with Joe. Joe thought he'd be great. If you weren't going to cast a star, that would be the way to go. Because he had the moves. He was the right age for our Peter Parker, who was, you know, let's say plus or minus 19 or 20, just out of high school and the first year of college. And that didn't work out. It's unfortunate. And I worked with him subsequently. I did a play reading last year, I think.
Well, then let me ask you this. Since you put, obviously, so much time into, say, Spider-Man, and I'm sure you've written other scripts that never came to fruition, or at least your version didn't, does that eat at you a little bit that you put all your heart and soul into something like the Spider-Man script and then to see it never materialize? Or did the check with all the zeros on it balance out the disappointment of not seeing your Spider-Man on the screen?
Well, I did. There was a lawsuit that I brought against Sony Columbia because, in fact, Sony Columbia had bought had optioned all previous scripts, and there were about six or seven drafts after ours, most of which stemmed directly from ours, either plot-wise or character-wise or grabbing this, that, and the other thing. And Sony optioned all of this material from MGM, which got it on Canon, went belly up. But the only two elements, the only two of the probably 11 different scripts, counting the Leslie Stevens thing before us, because we never saw that. The only two elements they exercised their option on, in other words, the only two written elements that they actually said, yes, we're going to take those, were what is called the Cameron material. That's a 40-page treatment by James Cameron and a script with six names on it, two of which are my partner and I. Now, we've never met James Cameron. Barney Cohen's name is on it, who had rewritten ours when Joe was working on it. And then there's James Cameron's name twice, indicating that he worked with two sets of writers, which was not true. He didn't work with any of them. He just stuck his name on it. And that was one of the elements that went over to Columbia. And I got all of the writers involved from us on through James Cameron to complain to the Writers Guild, saying, well, wait a minute, you know, you're not going to simply accept Columbia's word that David Koepp wrote all this. And the Writers Guild just shrugged and said, yeah, you're on your own. We went to the labor board. Eventually, I had to file suit and so on. So that, now, am I grumpy years later? Sure, because I found out firsthand the way Hollywood can work at that level. On the other hand, my partner and I think, can take justifiable credit of about 30% of what was in that first Spider-Man movie and about 25% of what was in the second. So that's kind of neat. You know, it's kind of nice that somebody thinks your work is good enough to steal.
But on the other hand, you don't get the credit for it. So other than the people that are hearing this interview and you kind of outing it publicly, does that part eat at you a little bit, that like David Koepp gets all the credit?
Yeah, I mean, if anybody cares. Now, on top of that, it's not just credit, because the way Hollywood is set up, at least you know, at a semi-professional level, you get a little tiny bit of what it makes in different markets, television, cable, and so on. if you're a member of the Writers Guild. Likewise, if you're a director, you get a little tiny bit of it, and it's like 2% of the net or whatever. But with something like that, I could have retired 10 years ago, you know, so that certainly hurts, you know, and that's the reason the guild is supposed to oversee these things. That they didn't was just unforgivable, but pretty typical. Yeah, of course that stings. And then if you tell somebody, they'll just look at you like, you don't know what you're talking about. That's not what it says on screen. That's the way it has always been.
Going back to low-budget films of the 90s.
So low-budget films of the 90s.
Yeah, low-budget films of the 90s. Was it sort of a brotherhood, like, you know, you and Decoto and Band and Kaufman and all that, kind of looking out for each other? Or was it as cutthroat as people imagined it was? That, you know, you were all, oh, man, I can put one over on Charlie, or, oh, man, I've got this actor that Decoto wanted, yes, or something like that?
I've never noticed any cutthroat stuff with anybody that I know. Most of the people that I know are actually friends. I remember I was shooting some additional scenes to a monster movie I did called The Naked Monster, a spoof of 1950s films. And I had the idea that I'd shoot a scene with Brink Stevens, who's the lead in that, and Laurie Nelson, who was a Universal player back in the 50s, and did a day that world ended for Corman, Revenge of the Creature, and so on. And she'd play a scientist, and Brink was a scientist, and they'd have funny dialogue. And as it turned out, the day that I had scheduled them, Fred Ray had scheduled both of them to be in the movie he was doing. And Fred's a pal. So I just said, fine, you know, we'll do it the next day. And that worked out just fine. There's a camaraderie. Like Dave Decoto, for example, who I adore. I mean, he's one of my best friends. He was the one that got me into to meet Charlie Band for the first time. And I, you know, bless him, because I worked with that company for a year or more. And Charlie I've always gotten along with. I mean, that's at another level entirely. He's the kind of guy that really does know how to finesse people into deals. And that's not necessarily something everybody can do. You know, that he's got a rascal streak through him a mile wide, that kind of mitigates things. But, you know, you have to be a salesman, and you have to believe whatever story you're telling somebody the moment you're doing it. And there's nobody that can do it like Charlie. I know that if somebody said, an actress does a film for Fred Ray, and Jim Wynorski's looking for somebody, he'll call Fred and say, you know anybody? And it's, yeah, I get a hold of such and such. And they'll end up working for them. I haven't noticed any. I don't think I've ever experienced any real cutthroat attitudes toward each other in this thing. And there probably is, but I've blessedly been insulated from it.
So now that I've played the interview, Alex, not only did what he say it was interesting, but do you see how coming from somebody that worked in the low-budget movie field, it really, you know, like that backyard zombie epic, you just cannot make your movie back today? Or make your money back, I mean?
Yes. No, yeah, it is very difficult to make your money back today. And because most of the stuff out there is crap.
And to be fair, in the 90s, a lot of it was too. For every Sorority Babes and the Slimeball, Bolarama, or Creepazoids that you had a violent shit or some other just piece of just trash that was boring, poorly made, or something like Fred Olen Ray's Evil Tunes. I'm not shitting on Fred Olen Ray. I just can't stand that movie. It's one of the most boring horror films I've ever sat through.
I have not even seen that one. I've seen plenty of Olen Ray stuff, but
and like, you know, like David Decoto. I brought up Sorority Babes and Creepazoids. I love those movies. I think even if you made those movies the same way today, I really don't know if there'd be a market for them. To me, the 90s were, and I know how dumb this sounds, they were a time capsule of that time. And that time does not translate to now. I think a movie like Sorority Babes and the Slimeball Bowl-O-Rama, it would not find the audience today that it did in 1988.
No, it definitely would not. But the big thing with the real low-budget direct-to-video, or rather direct-to-streaming, or red boxes nowadays, is there is a huge oversaturation of the market. And there is, like you said earlier, back in the 90s, for every Creepazoids, you also had a violent shit. Well, nowadays, for every actual quality direct-to-video movie you get, you have 10 violent shits.
Yeah, because everybody thinks they can be a director, and they can't.
Yeah.
But then let's also move on to the canon Spider-Man. Now, isn't it funny? I think this just shows the sea change that happened in Hollywood. Isn't it funny how in the 90s, Marvel was almost giving away their comic properties, please make a movie of this, and nobody wanted it. Whereas today, these things are so expensive because everybody wants it. What do you think caused that? Do you think just them having made, you know, a few hits like the X-Men or whatnot did that? Or did we as a culture change when it comes to comic book properties in a movie setting?
I think it's a mixture of both, that we as a culture changed. So when you had, and that's what allowed films like X-Men to become a hit. So it was a mixture of us changing to allow these movies to become a hit, to therefore make comics hot properties.
Because that's the part of Ted's interview that I thought was the most fascinating, that nobody wanted Fantastic Four. Nobody wanted Spider-Man. I remember when Canon, this is long after they stopped being Canon, but it was still released as Canon releasing, did the 1990 Captain America movie. Nobody wanted these things. And they were all really low budget. I mean, I know he said Spider-Man was budgeted at 18 to 20 million, but that's low budget compared to what I think a Spider-Man movie needs. I've seen the pre-production sketches and those comic book photo covers I talked to Ted about. I think that Canon Spider-Man could have been a really interesting project. Because if nothing else, look at the other things Canon made at that time, such as Masters of the Universe. Is it a good movie? No. Did they skimp on the budget? No. The movie looks phenomenal. And I think that's what Spider-Man could have been, even if it hadn't turned out to be a good movie. And I like Ted's writing, so I'm going to guess if they hadn't rewritten his script, it would have been decent.
And as Ted said, a lot of that script ended up in the later Spider-Man movies.
Which is what bears out my theory that it would have been decent regardless. Because a lot of his stuff ended up getting used by David Keop. To me, it's just kind of a shame that this Spider-Man is one of those could-have-beens. I think the Canon Spider-Man was a could-have-been. And in reality, since it never got released, that Fantastic Four movie that Corman made is technically a could-have-been.
I still need to see that.
It's not bad. It literally, fun is the way I'd put it. Is it a good movie? Not at all. Yeah, it is, especially now that you know the behind the scenes of it.
Now that I know the behind the scenes, that the actors didn't know that this movie was not meant to see the light of day.
Neither did the director or the composer. I think it's got a James Horner score.
That everyone associated with the movie was putting in 100% for something that nobody was ever going to watch.
And in a way, I think that's douchey on Corman's part.
Yes, so
at least let them know what's going on, that hey guys, this is why we're doing this. Not you put all your effort for it. You gotta remember, this got out there. I've got film threats and Starlog issues with this live action Fantastic Four on the cover. They were promoting this because that was part of the deal, obviously, since nobody could know they never meant to release it. You know, can you imagine being the director? Yeah, Mom, my movie is never coming out.
Given how you feel about the movie, would it have been a different movie if everybody was in on the joke?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I don't think it would have been as nearly as enjoyable as it was if they weren't trying. So that's why I see exactly what Ted was talking about. At the same time, I think it was kind of a douchey move on like a Hollywood sleazebag producer level.
Yeah.
So I do see both sides of that issue, and you raise a good point with that. Because, yeah, if they knew it was never going to be released, they would have half-assed the shit out of this.
Oh, quarter-assed it.
Yeah, that they would have just, well, as long as it looks like we're trying, good enough.
Yeah.
I hope you guys liked the interview with Ted Newsom. Maybe we can get him on again when Scott's on, because I know Scott would probably love to speak to the man. I know he'd have some interesting questions for him. So Scott most likely is not going to be on again next week if things work out. But if people want to find you, where can they?
GeekJuiceMedia.com.
You can find me there as well, since Alex is a business partner. And you can contact the show at LostInTheStaticShow@gmail.com. Have a good night, guys.